Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Matthew Soci, and well, this week the Film Sociology offices are closed because of the holidays. I know, but that being said, opening in theaters on Christmas Day, of course you have Wolf of Wall Street, Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, and then Grudge Match, so as well as 47 Ronin. All I can tell you is go check out Wolf of Wall Street first. Yes, people will compare it to Goodfellas as well as Casino, and people will say it's Scorsese's version of the film Wall Street, but it's a lot of fun, and it's almost 3 hours. And then follow that with Mandela, Idris Elba, as well as Naomi Harris. Really good performances, even though it has kind of a biopic script. Or as my buddy Laura Jansen says, I don't like biopics because they're movies about people. Anyway, we'll be back next week with our best and worst of 2013. We'll have hopefully a slew of guests from the Indiana Film Journalists Association. But we want to look back at some interviews I was able to conduct here at Film Sociology. And the beauty of the program is that everybody goes to movies and everybody has an opinion. So not only are we able to interview actors, filmmakers, writers, but we're also to have people on television, musicians, all walks of life sharing their ideas and opinions about movies. So we're going to do a little bit of that in this hour's show. Much thanks to Kobe Slagle for all of his hard work throughout the year. And we're going to start things off with a chat I got to do earlier this year with actor Jason Mewes, of course, one of the regular Kevin Smith players. He and Kevin Smith were in town for Jay and Silent Bob's super groovy cartoon movie? Superhero movie? Anyway, if you don't remember this one, here it is again. Here is my chat with Jason Mewes. Joining me on Film Sociology, it's been almost 20 years since we got to know this man in one way, shape, or form, and now he's finally on this show. He's going to be coming back to Indianapolis with a new film, a new animated epic. Jason Mewes, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you.
So I know this is the second Kevin Smith extravaganza coming to town, and I know you're going to be a part of Jay and Silent Bob's super groovy cartoon movie. Can you give us a preview of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome because it's going to be like two shows that are somewhat 3 hours of fun for, you know, one ticket price. But it's going to be a cartoon movie, so you can sit down. Go watch a movie. It's been about 70 minutes long. We're not sure. We're still doing a little touch-ups here and there. But get to sit down, watch a movie, animated movie. And then afterwards, we're going to do a Q&A / podcast, which is awesome. And then afterward, we also like the podcast, you know, as usual, at the end, you know, you get to bring 3-4 audience members up. We play a game, you know, and then who knows if, depending on time and our, if we have to leave to, you know, get ready to set off to the next city. If not, you know, I usually stick around afterwards and sign stuff and hang out and all that. So, you know, it's a lot of fun. I'm excited about it for myself, and I'm excited to see how the fans and the people who want to come watch the movie, the audience reaction, getting to sit there with them, watch the movie, you know, to sit there with them and watch it, because I've watched it, of course, and to sit there with other people and see how their reaction is and stuff, you know, it's something I'm looking forward to.
One of the things about this event, and I know Kevin does a lot of these, and of course you're a part of them as well, is that, I mean, you guys are like a band. Whether you got a new film to promote or not, you usually can hit the road and people come out to see you and want to talk and do all that stuff.
Yeah, no, it's been pretty awesome. You know, I know Kevin was for years doing his Q&A, stand-up or what have you. You know, and I used to go with him and maybe step on stage for 15, 20 minutes. Then I started doing my own Q&As all over Canada and at different colleges and things. And then we started Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, which is a live podcast. And we started touring with that. We went to London and Canada and Australia. And that's been fantastic. And we still do that. We do it like once a month at the Laugh Factory. And we still go on the road with that. But, you know, it's just been slowing down a little bit because now we're trying to focus on touring with the cartoon. So it's been amazing, man. It really has, because again, you know, I love shooting movies and you know, the process of making movies and getting to see the finished project afterwards, and you know, I've directed a music video and a little PSA, and I've done commercials and stuff, and so I'm just saying, like, it's doing all that is awesome, but it's also fun just going and doing Q&As and podcasts and all that, and getting to meet the people who are watching the movies and watching your stuff, and sit and chat with them afterwards and hang out and all that stuff. So it's really been an amazing 20 years or so.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, you mentioned you've produced and you've directed and all that. So you realize the amount of work and responsibility goes with that. So it's nice to know that something like this can be considered a breather for you. I know you're a producer on the movie. How's that experience for you? Because I know you've produced a couple of other projects. How is this one for you from a producer standpoint?
This one has definitely been different and an awesome experience, because this one is actually something I started, I've done from the beginning, and actually had to put in, more work than usual. Like, some of the other things I produced, I've been there and put in some creative points and been there every day to make sure things have gone, smoothly or what have you. But it was pretty easy and everything. This is from the get-go. Kevin gave me the script, and I told him I wanted to produce something from a movie, and he gave me the script, Jane Silent Bob's Groovy Cartoon Movie, and said, here, man, go see what you can do with it. And I brought it home to my wife, and we sat down and talked about it, and I knew first thing I had to do was see about getting an animator, how much it would be, how long it would take. Then I had to start thinking about who's going to do voiceovers for this character and who's going to be the voice for this character, and scheduling sound, sound studios and having them go there and meet and sit there while they went through the lines and just the whole process from beginning to end, and then send over that voiceover to the animator, and after, have them animate to it and send me it and say, oh, that's awesome, that's perfect, but can you change this up a little bit? And then Kevin got involved, and he really was stoked there. I got my wife and I got probably about 12 to 14 minutes of it done ourselves, and we went and showed it to Kevin, and he was shocked because he forgot forgot about it, but just didn't know I was going through with it and I had been doing stuff. And he was like, this is awesome, man. I can't believe it. We should get so-and-so to do a voice and this person to do a voice. So that was cool to see his excitement and see him now wanting to really get involved and step into it. And he started redoing some of the script because, he had written it, maybe 5 years ago or so. So some of the jokes were old and all that stuff. So it was really awesome, and it's definitely a great experience, being part of it from the very get-go.
So I watched a trailer on the website, and it seems like this is Bluntman and Chronic Returns or Begins?
Bluntman and Chronic are a big part of the movie, and it's pretty awesome. It is definitely, there's the villains, there's, I don't know...
In the trailer, your character, Jay and Silent Bob, he wins a scratch-off, and you decide to become superheroes. And of course, where there's superhero. So that's why I thought it was a little bit of Bluntman and Chronic Begins, because it's the origin of creating everything that you need in a superhero movie.
Yes, definitely a part of that. I mean, the whole idea is, like, when you see it, it's awesome, because they go through all this stuff, and then they pop up with this idea, and you'll see when, I don't want to give away a story of this.
Of course.
It's sort of it's goofy, but, they go, the first part of the movie, they're going through a good 5 to 10 minutes, they're going through these things that they could have, something could have happened, but then, anyway, so I'm very excited about it. And there's villains, but yes, it is a Bluntman and sort of the origin story, and then it goes on with the villains, and we've got great voices for that. We got Eliza Dushku and Ralph Garman, Neil Gaiman, John Lovitz, Ben Grebe, who does a podcast out here, and just great people have gotten involved with the project, and the editors, and the MC Chris, who does a song on it, and he's fantastic. There's a lot of really awesome people have chipped in and made the budget stay at a good price, not too much money, and really just have been psyched about being part of. So
Well, it seems like the film, it's also, do we have an official release date, or are we just going city to city like Red State?
Right now we're going city to city. We have no, we're not even sure what we want to necessarily do with it at this point after. Like right now we're focusing on touring it. We definitely want to do, we have the first leg of the tours in the 18 cities. We're already trying to set up to do like another 18 to 20, and then we're going to probably do it in like stints of 20, and then just see, you know, from now until at least October, November, we want to keep touring with it and try to get it over to Canada and Australia and London. And then from there, we're not sure. Do we want to try to get it on Netflix? Do we want to pop it up on iTunes and all that? So, you know, the good thing is the people who get to come see the show, they'll get to see it, in the theater, and then get the bonus of the Q&A and the podcast, and be the first one to see it. But yes, I definitely want to get it out there some way. I'm not sure, DVD, Blu-ray, what have you. Because, not everyone's going to get to go see the show live and while it's on tour. So.
Right. And it seems like the timing is good because we're coming off of the Avengers and Dark Knight Rises. There's been kind of a flux of superhero movies. And, of course, in the trailer, you guys wrote, the worst thing that happened to the comic book movie since Green Lantern.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's kind of at the same time, is this going to be a kind of a Valentine as well as a crotch punch to certain aspects of superhero movies?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yes, there's definitely, you'll get to see the crossover and sort of get definitely plenty of elements. And again, I don't want to give stuff away because
right.
That in itself is a big part of the beginning. And to me, is just awesome. Again, when Kevin gave it to me and I read it and reading through it, it's pretty funny. And especially the comic book people who know comics and stuff. They're going to get these sort of jokes and stuff, and it's going to, it's obvious if you know comics. If you don't know comics, you might miss a couple things, but probably not at this point because you're right. Like, I feel like they're all the comic book movies and how much more aware people are of comics, the superheroes and stuff is a lot more now.
For research on this, and I love calling this research, I watched Clerks, Dogma, and Zack and Miri. Back to back to back. And, it's funny. Like I said, it's almost, next year will be 20 years. First off, obviously Clerks is one of the most quoted films of all time. Everybody should send you guys a royalty check because we use it so much at work and everybody else. And then with a film like Dogma, where you guys were an integral part of the plot, and then to see you and Zack and Miri, and by the way, we saw way too much of you. Thank you very much for that.
I know.
Yeah, Harvey Keitel, Ewan McGregor, Michael Fassbender, and you. Thanks. But it's been great to look on like your IMDb page and see characters not named Jay and going back and forth between Kevin Smith projects and not Kevin Smith projects. I mean, did Kevin have to check with you this time to see if there's a schedule conflict for you?
No, I mean, not really. It's funny because there are a few things that I'm doing that right now, like it's been the last year has been a big, a lot of stuff we have done together. And, he has some stuff he's working. He did a Fox project. And he's doing a bunch of different stuff without me. And a lot of stuff we're doing together. So yeah, it's funny when I do sit when he's like, hey, I'm going to come over, maybe let's record a podcast for Wednesday and announce this or do this. And then I'll be like, oh man, I'm shooting this thing. I'll be like, wait, what are you shooting? Who are you shooting with? it's pretty funny, but not necessarily check with him, but I definitely, again, a lot of this, we do have a lot of stuff we're doing. We just he directed, and then him and I were in, and I don't know because they haven't announced it, so I don't know how much I want to talk about, but
okay.
There's that new Injustice game.
All right.
Yes, which is fantastic. We got to play a little piece of it, and it's so awesome. It's like, there's Doomsday, and there's Solomon Grundy in it, and Greenlight, all the people and people you wouldn't even expect. But anyway, it's a fighting game, and we got to play a little bit. But anyway, it's going to be coming out soon, and we got to do, Kevin got to direct a commercial, and we were in it. And that was just fantastic, to be part of the game and do a commercial for that. So I'm just saying he's like doing other stuff, and he's directing other things, and he's writing, he's writing another book now. But a lot of things we do together. But it's been great that I've been able to step out and do some other things. And right now it just seems it sort of has timed out perfect because, you know, we were touring with Get Old and we were doing this in the podcast here at Laugh Factory. But I've done like a movie here, 2 days on this movie, and I'm meeting with someone about doing another movie. Me and my buddy Christian Sesma and Paul Sloan are about to shoot this really awesome web series. We're about to shoot the first 20 minutes of it, and then if it goes well, we're going to keep doing them. But it's such a great concept and idea this guy Paul Sloan came up with. I'm really psyched about it. So we do that next week. So it's cool. I get to step out and do some other things and then still work with Kevin and focus on the tour.
Yeah, and you have an action figure and you're on comics and you're on games. You know, you're living the dream, sir.
Definitely. I mean, it's like me and my wife sit around sometimes and I told her, like, at one point, you know, we were just sitting around. We didn't have a lot going on for a couple, like a month or so. And we were just chatting and I was like, you know what? I was like, I get antsy if I'm not being productive and working, but I was like, I feel like it's okay to sit around a couple of weeks because, you know, how blessed and grateful I am. I've got an action figure, a comic book, and who would have thunk that I'd ever have, you know, who doesn't want an action figure and to be in a comic book and all that? So a cartoon and movies, and I got to do commercials. So I'm definitely grateful and, you know, I got lucky. I came, you know, I was roofing when Kevin wrote Clerks, the first movie. And even after we shot that movie and he went out to Sundance, I didn't know that you can go to film festivals and people actually buy movies. And if they do buy them, not only do they buy them, if they like your stuff, they offer you to do another movie or maybe two other movies. And so I didn't know anything about it. So, yeah, it was pretty, I lucked out and I'm very grateful.
If you don't mind me asking, how long have you been married?
I've been married, actually January 30th was 4 years, and we've been together almost, July will be 7 years we've been together.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm married going on 14, and actually one of the first movies my wife and I went to when we were dating was Chasing Amy.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
Like 14 years, wowzers. How long? So you've been together like 16 or
about
so, huh?
16, with an 11-year-old daughter, and she's not ready for your work yet.
Yeah,
not yet. Close.
No, I know my niece lets my, like I have a half sister and her kids are, you know, 23 all the way up to 35 or whatever. And they have kids. And my youngest niece, I call her my niece, but her kid is like 11 and the other one's 14 and she let them watch Jay and Bob. And I remember the 11-year-old was like, you know, singing the F song and stuff. And I was like, how do you know all the words? She's like, we love that movie. You know, that's my family. That's why in Zach and Miri, actually, it was like the only thing I was nervous about showing so much. It wasn't like, oh, gosh, people are going to see it and say it's tiny or something. I was just nervous because I'm like, I know my niece is going to let her kids watch the movies because she lets them watch all my movies because, you know, they're all happy for me and proud. And so I was like, oh, you can't let them see this part. Towards the end, when Seth Rogen's banging on the door and she's on the toilet, make sure they close their eyes.
So I'm curious, what movies have you watched recently, new or old?
I watch tons. I haven't watched a whole lot of movies. I'm so into TV. I watch way too many TV shows. Actually, I just was sitting before I called you watching The Following.
Okay.
That new Kevin Bacon show. But anyway, I'd say the last movie that sticks out is my wife wanted to watch it, and we watched Silver Lining Playbook.
Oh, good.
And before that, we watched Argo and then Dark Knight, you know, some of the screeners. So.
Sure.
I'm more into TV, man. I haven't watched, besides watching those screeners, because I was like, oh, I got to watch Argo. I want to see The Hobbit. I want to see Dark. We watched Dark Knight again. But even though I had seen that one a couple times, and then Silver Lining we wanted to watch because our friend John Gordon is producer on it, and we kept hearing all these things and about it, so we wanted to see that it lived up to the hype. But yeah, TV's it's big in the TV. The Following I'm watching, The Cult. There's a show called The Cult. There's another show, Zero Hour, Suits. Heights and White Collar and Bones, and I've watched so many different shows. Arrow, I'm really into right now. I think Arrow's really awesome, and Vampire Diaries, I really dig.
Man, your DVR thumb must be sore.
You know what? I watch it all on Netflix. And,
okay.
And except for the new ones I watch on Hulu. I just, you know, Hulu, I watch the up-to-date ones. We actually got rid of our cable because we honestly never used it. We, like, used it every once in a while. Like, when Game of Thrones was on, we wanted to use it because we wanted to have that station to watch it on DVR and stuff. But now with, you know, Hulu is pretty awesome for those week-to-week shows.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't come on Hulu and they're not on Netflix, then I'll iTunes them and buy them.
Yeah.
I bought way too many iTunes shows. You know, now with the iCloud, it shows you what shows you bought, even if you've erased them and got rid of them. And it's just insane. I go through my list of stuff of TV shows, and there's like, you know, 300 different shows. And I mean, I definitely have spent a good, you know, $20,000, I'd say, in the last 2 years on iTunes. At least 10,000, 20 might be high, but at least $10,000 on iTunes TV shows in the last 2 years, year and a half.
Well, this is why people should buy tickets to go see you at Butler when the movie comes to town.
Definitely. They definitely need to come see it. And again, besides getting to see the movie, you know, I think the bonus is, because I know it's hard, people, I think it's hard for people to want to get out of the house and go drive down to theater and stuff and see stuff, but it's not just getting to see the cartoon and Jay and Bob, which has been, you know, it's been years and years since you've seen Jay and Bob in a live action or cartoon, but you get the Q&A and you get a podcast, and that's usually we do a Q&A or we do a podcast, and so this is going to be a little unusual. It's going to be a Q&A / podcast, and not to mention we'll be playing games. We'll play Let Us F, where we bring three audience members up, and, you know, you give them some name, like the Indianapolis Ass Slapper, and then you got to have air sex to that position. You got to come up with a position and be like, okay, how are we going to get across the Indianapolis Ass Slap? So anyway, it's fun. I wish we do that on our Get Old podcast when we tour and we go on the show and people seem to dig it, and it's fun. And so, yeah, man, I think people enjoy it. Movie, little intermission for some, you know, get some drinks and whatever else. Then you're going to get a Q&A / podcast, and it's going to be a blast.
Besides age, what do you think has changed the most between the characters Jay and Silent Bob?
I mean, I think the character, I mean, when Kevin rewrites the movies each time, I mean, he definitely, they're the same guys, but they definitely adapt to sort of what's really going on in our life. You know, as you could see, if you watch Clerks 2, Jay's talks about being sober and going, you know, getting pulled over with an airbag. Like, that really happened. You know, it's like, you know, the characters still are always hanging out together. Jay's still always, they're always buddies hanging out, you know, never leaving each other's side. We're always outside selling weed. That's how we make our living out there. So, sort of, if you follow the movies, you'll see. But I'd say as with age, with the actual characters, you know, I think they're just sort of, you know, they're still just being themselves and hanging out and enjoying hanging out with each other and harassing people. Because, you know, if you see later on in the movies, they have money from the movie rights.
Right.
From Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back. So Clerks 2, they go in to buy the Quick Stop and all that business. And, you know, so they have money, but they're still hanging out because that's what they like to do. You know, so I just think they're getting a little wiser and smarter and trying to come up with stuff. And I think, you know, I'd love it if Kevin decides to write another movie to sort of wrap it up. I mean, again, we have the animated, but that's its own story. If we can do another live movie, you know, there's been talks, Clerks 3, hopefully things will work out and maybe that'll happen. But I think there should be a wrap-up saying, like, hey, man, we're not going to be hanging out anymore. Or we will hang out, but we've decided to do this and this and this. We're going to, you know, buy our own place, and this is where we're going to stay and sleep. And maybe we're going to have a little Jay and Silent Bob kids or something. I don't know. Maybe we'll adopt a bunch of kids.
It's great. Daddy daycare. That's great.
Exactly.
No, it sounds like there's just enough gray area to be in between art imitating life, as far as, you know, stuff that's happened in your life, but it's been movie-sized by some writing. And I assume you don't do the tuck dance in public.
Not anymore. That's something that I used to do all the time when I was, 15, 16 years old. I used to do that a bunch, And again, a lot of this stuff is stuff that you're right. It's like crossover from real life to that. Like, no, I don't really hang out. I did at one point hang out in front of Welsh Farms with a bunch of my friends. We never sold marijuana, but we used to smoke a lot of marijuana. I don't smoke anymore, but Kevin does. Just like the characters. We are best friends. We do hang out all the time. He does talk a lot, though. He's not quiet like in the movies. And, just a lot of those stories, that you see. Like, I used to yell to women that would walk by, "Hey, yo, what up, baby? Yo, what up?" And I used to pull my junk out and just all different stuff. So there is a good crossover there.
Some things are timeless, my friend.
Yeah, so, it'd be nice to sort of end up, too, like in real life, maybe we got to put a little, we got to do at least one more movie to sort of show where Jay and Bob are going to end up here.
My chat with Jason Mewes. This is Film Sociology. It's an end of the year retrospect. We're doing the fresh air thing this week. I'm your host, Matthew Soucy. We'll be back next week with a whole new program. We'll be going over the best and worst of 2013. We're probably the last people to do it because it's first Friday in January. Anyway, we now move on to a chat I had with Indiana singer, actor, musician, guitarist, Renaissance man, and he was a really good sport for letting me call him that. That's Tim Grimm, who appeared in, for me, one of the biggest surprise films of 2013, the farm drama At Any Price with Dennis Quaid and Zac Efron. Here's my chat with Tim Grimm talking about that film, as well as some other titles from his IMDb page. So, Tim, how often have you been called a Renaissance man?
A Renaissance man.
You bounce from stage, screen, TV, music. It's not a bad job to have.
I think half a dozen times I've been called a Renaissance man.
Okay, so now seven.
If you're going to make it seven, so be it.
Okay. Yeah. So for those who don't know, tell folks about the film At Any Price.
At Any Price was shot a couple of summers ago up in central Illinois in the Decatur area, up in real true farmland. And it was director Ramin Barani's fourth film, but his first real film with known, recognizable actors of some stature, like Dennis Quaid. And it's an interesting film. It's a personal film on a farming level. It's also a little bit of a political film in the sense that it's talking about contemporary farming issues like GMOs and marking seeds, selling seeds, etc.
And for those who haven't seen it, what is your big moment in the film?
My big moment is as Farmer Alex, one of Dennis's former seed customers. He's both a farmer and a seed salesman. My big moment is when he comes over to try to pitch me on his latest seeds, and we have a lovely little scene that ends up going out on motorcycles across the field.
How did you get involved with the project?
As most of these things happen, I'll get a call from my agent up in Chicago. I've been working with an agent up there for about 25 years at least, and we've had a great relationship. They'll call me when a casting director calls them about a project coming into town, and this was that same scenario, and I went up and did a reading on tape or film, and then the director came to town and requested to meet with me. And I ended up reading for three or four parts in that movie, which is always the light. You think your heads go up, exponentially if you are asked to read for more than one part. But he pretty much, I would be in the movie, he just didn't know where and how.
And so how long before you found out?
This one, you've got a pretty good inkling. They'll tend to put you on what they call hold, which can last anywhere from 2 or 3 days to a couple of weeks. And I think this was technically a couple of weeks at least before we found out exactly what I would be doing in the movie. Although, as I said, I was pretty confident I would have some part in there.
And how long did your portion take?
I went up twice. First time I went up, I filmed 2 days on location at the farm and where we shot. And then the third time I went up, it was shot seasonally. And so we shot in the early part of summer, and then we shot the mid part of fall during harvest season. So I went up during harvest season as well for one of the final scenes in the movie, which is a big sort of a company picnic that a lot of the neighbors are invited to.
Now, did you get a chance to read the whole script, or did you just read the parts that you auditioned for?
In this instance, I did get to read the whole script. It's a good question. It's about at least half the time you don't get a whole script. You don't get a complete script. You certainly don't often get a complete script before when you're initially auditioning. The further along you go in the process, the more chance you've got of getting that whole script. But I did get a whole when I was cast. So I knew what was on paper, and it's a thing to follow and track and see where that goes and what develops out of that script, because some directors are real sticklers. Somebody like Michael Mann, who I've worked with twice on The Insider and on the Dillinger movie with Johnny Depp, he's a person who basically, if it's on paper, that's the way it will be done. And he really controls so many aspects of the film, from details about costumes to colors of vehicles and everything. He wants his hand in that. And other directors, you know, are much more loose with that. It's an interesting process, therefore, to track it from beginning to end, see how it ends up.
What did you think of the film overall? Because I know it tackles issues that I don't think really had been addressed at the as far as what happens as far as sales and with other farmers.
Yeah, it's certainly, I don't think it's been, Matthew, I don't think it's been addressed in this kind of format. You're right. It has been addressed somewhat in documentary films, films like Food, Inc., and it's certainly been addressed in places like, you know, sections of the New York Times. But you're right, in terms of a commercial film, feature film, it's not been. And I think it's a pretty good job. I do remember when we had a week and a half run here down in Columbus when the movie was first available, and I did serve talkbacks with audiences here, and there were some questions of confusion about the seeds and the corn versus soybeans and the GMO issues. He tries not to make the film all about that, and therefore I think that it does raise some questions that aren't quite answered. I think, you know, overall the film does a fine job, you know, kind of balancing the family story and the political side of agribusiness. I don't know, you've read some of the early reviews that came out or not from the festivals when it first showed a year and a half ago. But they were a really interesting mixed bag. Some of the reviewers just said this is Death of a Salesman meets Grave of the Wrath. And some people said, you know, it's Dennis Quaid's best performance. Others said he was horrible. So I couldn't wait to see it, you know, to kind of make up my own mind.
Well, I like the fact, I think when you have polarizing opinions, that seems like it's, you, no matter what, you've made a bigger impact. I think being mediocre is probably even worse than being bad.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
And I remember watching it and thinking, it was funny you mentioned Death of a Salesman and Grapes of Wrath. I kept thinking of it as almost a Shakespearean tragedy. And without giving away anything, the film sticks to its guns. I don't think there was a focus group saying you should change this, you should change that.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And without giving anything away either, anything specific, I had several people comment at the talkbacks down here that it's relentless, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In some regards, it is relentless. And, you know, if one is looking for a, quote, feel-good movie, and depending on one's definition or expectations of hope in film, you know, you got to be open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that. I like your kind of analogy with Shakespeare as well, because Yeah, it's you know, we look back at a Shakespearean play or a work and we go, wow, these are life and death issues. And Hollywood tends to dramatize it a particular way that aren't as gritty and down to earth and real seeming. And this one is very real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe why it's unsettling for some people.
Now, of course, the film is out on DVD and Blu-ray. Have you got a copy of it yet?
I don't have a copy yet. I just was in my red box and I saw the big ad for it. So,
good.
Yeah, I'll have to get a copy one of these days.
You're not hanging out in front of the red box, right? Just suggesting.
No, well, it is. Yeah. Right. What's next? No, I'm not hanging out.
And there isn't a Tim Grimm portion of your library at home?
There is sort of, you know, I have real mixed feelings about that. You know what I mean? But I think like a lot of actors and performers there, you know, we have to have some amount of ego to just survive. And the balance for me, at least, and a lot of people with actually a true level of shyness and what am I doing here? And why am I doing this? So it's, I do, and I started to do it when the kids got older, have a little library, because there's really now close to a dozen films that I've done, and I've got a bunch of the television stuff that I did also on DVD, movies and stuff like that. So it's interesting, and occasionally we'll go back and look at that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Now, this is your second time with a Dennis Quaid film. Do you have a connection with him, or is it just work?
Not really. You know, when we did The Express, I reminded him. It's actually sort of the third time, because when I graduated from high school, I graduated in '78, and that summer after high school, before I went to college there in Richmond at Earlham College, I saw a notice in the local paper. They're casting bicycle racers for this new movie called Breaking Away.
Of course.
And I actually hopped on my bike in Columbus, and I was doing a lot of centuries, 100-mile rides, and I hopped on my bike and rode over and met the casting director for Breaking Away, and ended up getting in a couple of those racings, and played an extra in a couple of other scenes, and it was kind of my taste of that, or foot in the water of that. But technically, it's maybe my third movie with Dennis Quaid.
So we'll have to press pause next time we watch it.
Oh, big time. Big time. You need super slow-mo. Yep.
See, this is fun.
Freeze frame.
This is fun. This is like the Hoosier story, where I think they've had about 500 extras, but about 20,000 people have said they've been in Hoosiers. But, you know, we'll look for you on pause. Now, I was, of course, doing research, and I love the fact that watching The Insider and Backdraft is research. But going through your IMDb file, it's great that you have a number of actual character names over job descriptions in your resume.
To get a character name is sort of important to me anymore, you know. Occasionally the movie where, you know, the second Chicago cop, second East Chicago cop or something is what we ended up doing in the Dillinger movie. And basically, I'm not going to complain about that, because even with the best freeze frame, I don't think you'll ever find me in that film. We had a nice scene, Christian Bale, and that whole thing is gone. That whole segment of the movie is gone. It's right before Dillinger gets shot. And what can you do?
Right.
And I learned that early on, back in shooting Clear and Present Danger. And I had probably three other sizable scenes with Harrison Ford that just the two of us that were cut from the film. And I'm not complaining about screen time in that movie at all, because there's a nice amount. But I did learn that you have no control over that. But I also have learned over the years that I like to have a name. You know, give me a name.
So long as your name is on the check as well.
Exactly. Yep.
Now, I know you worked with Michael Mann twice. Did you get Public Enemies because of your work in The Insider, or was that through the agent as well?
No, it helped a lot. Michael Mann, when I did go in for an initial taping, and when Michael went through those tapes, he was aware that I was working on the Chicago market at that point. And so I ended up going in a couple more times. There was one slightly larger part, a pretty good part actually, that I was up for until the very last minute. And they cast somebody very, very physically different than me for that other part. But he was gunning for me in a positive way. I think he wanted to be able to use me in that film in some capacity. So that was a nice result of having worked with him before.
Now, I watched The Insider last night preparing for this, and this is one of those films that you get sucked in immediately, even if you're channel surfing and you feel you should devote 20 to 30 minutes watching it. How long did it take to shoot that? And I'm always thinking of the sequence where you and the other actor are following Russell Crowe from the living room to the bedroom.
Right, right. That took, we actually shot that pretty quickly, and I want to say that whole sequence, actually from the and maybe our car pulls up and we're going across the lawn into the house till the time we leave. I think we're on that probably 8 hours, 8 or 9 hours. So not bad, you know. I mean, it's not terribly long. We shot that in a day.
Nothing Kubrick-like.
No.
And I guess, can you tell folks what you remember most about working on Backdraft?
Backdraft was cool. It was my first, real big feature film. A couple of independent films before that, and Backdraft was this. Everything was in a way compressed for me because I'm in a medium sized room with Robert De Niro and Donald Sutherland, you know, basically sitting across the table from two guys. And I did pinch myself a couple of times that day. We shot that a couple of days. I pinched myself both days, you know, and I remember. I think the morning of the second day, and I'm walking down the hallway, and I just De Niro coming down the hallway toward me, you know, and he's, you know, he fiery, intense, and really staying into character, and got that sort of serious, almost glum look on his face. And, you know, as I walked by, I'm thinking, do I say something? You know, we worked one day together, and we're going to work today. And, he looked up at me and said, hey, and then nodded and walked on down the hall, you know. Robert De Niro's an eye to me. I was, in the beginning of this, so it was a lot of fun.
A title I was curious about, because I have not seen it, but I have talked to, I've had one of my first guests on the film show was F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What was it like working on Joshua?
Oh, he was delightful. It was a lot of fun. It was almost a Hoover campy for me because... I'm playing a bishop, and I'm wearing the long robes the entire time, and we have a scene where he comes into my office and pleads a particular case, and I'm the guy with a fair amount of humor in that scene, and he was delightful. He mm-hmm. was one of those people there, and they're out there who. We're just, you know, really regular, everyday guys who take into account, you know, I'm a well-known person, F. Murray Abraham. You are not, you know, but I'm going to treat you just like my best friend. It's interesting because you really get an idea of personalities in this business, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's a working guy.
Yep, so. Exactly. Yep.
Now, how often have you had your music used in TV or movies?
When I was back in the day in the early 90s, when I was on Reasonable Doubts on NBC for 2 years, in the second season after the first year ended, I was disbarred as a lawyer. I was divorced by my wife, but I came back the second season out of prison and followed my dream, which was to be a blues singer on the series.
Mm-hmm.
That was the character's dream. So I actually did two episodes with a barroom blues band and played in two of those episodes. And I also had another, I think, so I had three episodes of that show. But other than that, on film, no. I actually pitched to Ramin some of my farm song material for Benny Price, but they had already set their sound designer and the music person for that show, so didn't work.
Well,
I keep trying.
Exactly. What else you got to lose?
Right.
Now, I'm not going to ask how much, but how often do checks pop up in the mail?
They're really on a quarterly basis, pretty much.
Okay.
Some things can come in loosely, like I get at odd times residuals that are foreign residuals, and they'll come in about, I can tell it's a pink envelope, and it's an explanation sheet of perhaps all the S's, Switzerland and Sweden and Sudan or someplace, are going six of the movies of the week that I shot, you know, 10 years ago. And they don't add up to a lot, put it that way, when they're foreign stuff. But, yeah, it's probably four times a year I'll get a series or batches of checks pretty much from everything I've ever done. And it's a nice perk of being an actor. They do get smaller and smaller, however, as time goes on. But it's kind of like Christmas money.
Tad Robinson calls them hello checks.
Yeah.
Because that's what you say when you pop it open.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, exactly. Very sweet.
So what are you working on next?
I'm heading over to Ireland in about a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I am leading a tour of about 20 music fans of mine, 10 days. And from there, I go with my wife, son, and a Dutch fiddle player to the Netherlands, the UK, Germany, and Italy for about 6 weeks of touring music.
Not a bad life.
I'm not going to complain about that one. And then in the winter time, I'm going to go to Oslo Rep Theater in Sarasota, and we're going to remount The Grapes of Wrath, which we did at IRT many years ago.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate your time, but I'm curious, do you have a DVD copy of Steel Magnolias?
No, I have got a VHS copy.
Better than nothing.
Exactly. You've not seen it, have you?
No, I was checking IMDb, and that was that the very, very first thing you did, TV-wise?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
What do you remember, Jackson?
Which is what we named. I remember that happened in a whirlwind. I was, again, my Chicago agent called, said they are shooting a pilot for Steel Magnolias, and I was aware of it as a play, and I think I was aware of it as a movie. And they want to make a television series, and can you come in? It's one of those, can you come in tomorrow and be put on tape, because this thing is going to go very quickly. I went in, and I did a taped audition, and they, like, overnighted it. I stayed in Chicago, and then they wanted an adjustment, so which means that the director wanted to see something slightly different, or maybe a different scene. I gave him the adjustment, and they said, okay, you are going to fly out tomorrow to L.A. to meet the director and the producer, and if you get it, they're only going to see two or three people, if you get it, you will immediately fly down to Natchitoches, Louisiana, and begin shooting. And the story with this piece was that, which I found remarkable and kind of amazing and kind of ludicrous at the same time, is that they could not find the actor they wanted to play Jackson in Los Angeles. And they were widening the scope, but they'd gotten so far that production was already scheduled. So I went out, met with the director, met with the producer, and they hired me. And the next thing I knew, I was in Nacogdoches, working with, you know, Cindy Williams and Wayne Stritch and Polly Bergen, just an amazing, you know, assortment of women down there. And I felt very lucky.
Well, Tim, thank you for representing the Midwest on that one. And in general.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you for what you're doing, too, out here in the Midwest.
We do what we can. My chat with Indiana artist Tim Grimm. Well, we got time for one more interview highlight. This is a short one compared to the others, but I occasionally get to talk to people like Jonathan Scott, Ingrid Hoffman, folks on TV. Of course, I'm partial to the Food People, Food Network and Cooking Channel, obviously, if you listen to the show. So, and also, this will make Kobe Slagle's eyes roll. Here's my chat with Claire Robinson, host of Five Ingredient Fix and many others, talking about her her work for 2014, and movies with cooking.
Matt, can you hear me?
Yeah.
What's up?
How are you, Claire?
Good. How are you?
You know, I do a lot of studio work here at the station, and Wednesday mornings at 10, you keep me company.
I do?
Yes, you do.
Oh, I love that. So. I love that. I'm glad you're there on Wednesdays at 10. That's my moment.
Absolutely. I got to see you cook Russian food this morning.
Oh, did you see me poorly say Nostrovia?
Better you than me.
Yes, it took me a lot of practice, like about 2 days, sadly.
What is the five flavor forecast for 2014?
All right, this is so cool. McCormick, for their 125th anniversary, I'm really excited about this because it's a company that has literally been around for 125 years. So they've given so much to us. We all know those red cap spices. They're absolutely amazing. But they're giving back this year. So for their birthday, they're kind of giving us presents. And one of them is their flavor forecast. This is interesting because you think that the flavor forecast is talking about the hottest flavors and trends and food that you're going to see over the next 1 to 3 years. But you think that it would be all about spice. It's not. It's actually legitimately the new flavors and the new food trends you're going to see coming in and out of kitchens over the next 1 to 3 years. And I think that it's such a neat thing. They've been doing this for 14 years. One of their previous flavor forecasts was in 2003, and it was Chipotle. And now that's everywhere.
Right.
So they're obviously right on the money.
So now, with somebody's, have you developed recipes for the new flavors?
I didn't actually develop any of the recipes. I'm just really excited to be working with them and talking about the flavor forecast. So, you know, what's so exciting is this is something that really helps people like me come up with, you know, with what I should be inspired by. So, for example, the trends have flavors within the trends. So they have five trends, Chili's Obsession, but within that, there's flavors like Chili's de Ovo. Now, Chipotle is one of the chilies that we all know, red pepper chili flakes. But it's, you know, they're telling me and they're forecasting that more and more people are going to know about something like Chili's de Ovo, which is actually a chili I love. So that kind of gives me this inspiration to start using that more in my recipes, and hopefully people will learn more about it and actually be able to find it. They have clever compact cooking is one of their trends. But within that, you know, again, as I said, it's not all about spices. They're forecasting that people are going to start to use pressure cookers more and more, and because pressure cookers are more, I guess, multifunctional is the best way to put it. They'll be the new slow cooker. The way, you know, you can get dinner on the table faster than you can get takeout. So it's a really exciting way. They've written recipes, though, celebrating some of these new trends. And within the clever compact cooking, the flavor as well of tea. So Lapsang Souchong tea, is that something you've ever cooked with?
I have not personally, but now that you've mentioned it, I'll add it to the list.
You know, it's kind of like chicken or egg, which is predicting what. But they're forecasting that tea will become a hot ingredient for people that have these compact kitchens, these small kitchens, which I'm one of them. I'm from Tennessee. I moved to New York. My kitchen is so tiny, it's the size of most people's bathrooms. That's pathetic. And so for me, I really have to think about every single thing in my kitchen. I don't have a pantry. It's my countertop. Mm-hmm. So I really try and use these ingredients in more than one way. Now, I'm a chef, but this is something that they're predicting will happen in everybody's kitchen. It'll become much more commonplace.
Well, it's funny. I think what you mentioned, the pressure cooker, I think everybody's worried about getting it locked correctly and, you know, getting steam shot in their face, that sort of thing. So I think once you actually know how to work it, then, you know, it'll be used more.
Exactly. But, you know, the interesting thing is it just takes that becoming more of a popular appliance. And for me, I would much rather replace appliances that don't have as much function with appliances I can use in more than one way.
Mm-hmm.
And pressure cookers, I mean, it's everything from putting together a quick chowder that has chorizo and this tea in it and smoky flavors of cumin and deliciousness. I'd rather have that on my counter and be able to last minute put something on the table than to have to think about it before I go to work, because let me tell you, I can barely remember my keys when I walk out the door in the morning. I'm not a morning person.
Well,
but, you know, the funny thing is, you know, McCormick isn't selling pressure cookers. They're just predicting these really cool trends that you're going to see in kitchens, the flavors within those trends, like Mexico, you're going to see charred tomatillo, and Brazil, because we've got the World Cup and the Olympics, you're going to see guava and something called cassava flour.
Well, so what does 2014 look like for you? I know you got the cookbook. That's still running strong, and we hope to see you on the telly more.
Yes, I am working on some new stuff. Fingers crossed that you'll get to see it by spring. I'm excited. And, you know, in the meantime, it's really fun because I'm kind of in my creating phase right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing a lot of new recipes and looking for inspiration constantly, which is really exciting. That's why I said I'm, you know, these recipes are McCormick recipes, but I'm using them as inspiration to write my own. So you might see a couple of wacky new ingredients in my few ingredient cooking, because I'm still sticking with my few ingredients. That's my thing, and it's the way I like it. I don't like to count on more than one hand.
It is less is more. I mean, I think five ingredient fix is one of the smartest concepts. I mean, that really brings it to, if you can do it with five, you can make anything great.
Exactly. And you know what's great is I'm so complimented when somebody comes up to me and says, oh, I added this ingredient to your blank recipe. And to me, that's flattering because they made it their own. I'm giving them a wonderful base recipe that's good as is. But from there, that's how you really learn to cook. I want people to be the chef of their own kitchen. Mm-hmm. So when you learn about new ingredients and you learn about new flavors that are supposed to hit your kitchen and you add them to recipes you already like, then you're a chef and you are the executive chef of your kitchen.
Now, this is a film show, so I'm asking, have you been able to watch any new films recently?
Films, oh my goodness, yes, I have, and I'm really excited. One of them has not come out yet, The Wolf of Wall Street. I was able to see a little trainer thing.
Uh-oh.
And it was awesome.
Excellent.
It was just awesome. I didn't even know how to tell you. It was so good. I can't tell you. I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
It's so good. I'm really excited. I really want to see the new one, The American Hustler.
Yes.
That's coming out. I think that's going to be great. And, you know, I'm in New York, so we get into those indie films.
Of course. Tribeca.
Yes, Tribeca. Tribeca. And I actually live near the Angelica, so I go there and hit the new indie films. I just, you know, it's exciting. Right now, I feel like we've got a good film season coming up.
What are some of your favorite cooking moments in cinema? I mean, can you see somebody if they know how to work in the kitchen or not when they're being filmed? Movie-wise?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, we all seen Kitchen Confidential, right, with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes.
She really worked hard to get the process of putting on her wife, the apron, the way she put them on. It really is for chefs, especially restaurant chefs that are in there every day, it is almost a ritual, and it's a very distinct, very specific process that's done the exact same every day. You don't miss a beat. She practiced that through and through, and I really felt like she looked like she knew what she was doing. She held a knife correctly. But yes, I catch all the time people that are holding a knife incorrectly, and and they're supposed to know what they're doing, and in 1 second I can tell they don't. One of my favorite ones, though, chocolat.
Yep.
That's not the sexiest chocolate like moment on television.
It also helps that Juliette Binoche has the over-the-shoulder dress handing you chocolates.
Yes. I mean, it's just good. It was good. I loved that one.
And there you have it, friends, my chats with Claire Robinson, Tim Grimm, and Jason Mewes. Well, the clock on the wall says film sociology is over for now. We'll be back next week highlighting the best and worst of 2013. It was a solid, solid year for cinema. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty of them out there right now, so there's no excuse. And until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. We gone. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California. Good night, Pahrump. Good night, Michigan.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street.